This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. The program today is about being a better you. Later, we'll get some tips on how to find your own personal work style. Understanding that can lead to improved performance and a much simpler life. That is one of the topics to be discussed at the TWIST Conference for Women, hosted later this month by Queen's University of Charlotte. And so is this, fighting something most of us have, feelings of inadequacy despite any achievements we may have enjoyed. There's a name for it. Imposter syndrome. Lou Solomon is a communications consultant and CEO and founder of Interact. She's also the author of Freeing Your Radical Hero, Fighting the Imposter Mindset. And she's also the co-founder of the TWIST Conference, which, by the way, is, I'm told, sold out. That makes the exploration of these two topics on today's program even more valuable. So welcome to the program, Lou. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mike.
Lou has been broadcasting for years and years and years and then wised up.
I don't know about that. It was a wonderful experience.
Well, you have written and you're speaking about defeating imposter syndrome. And I think I know that I have this. I mean, I know it because I've actually had the thought, you don't know what you're doing. And I've had the thought that I've been given assignments along the way in this storied career of mine where I had to do certain things that I had never done before. And I thought, well, I'll just pretend that I'm this person, and I'll do it. But as I was doing it, I would think to myself, you're not that. That's not what you are. You're just a phony. You're a phony. That's what this is all about, right?
It is.
So we've all had these thoughts.
That's right. And you being a broadcast personality, Mike, in addition to an actor, I know you do that on the side.
That is all phony.
That makes you the perfect candidate. So it's not surprising that you understand. In fact, 70% of all successful people have experienced the symptoms of imposter thinking. And a number of folks will say, when hearing about this, that's me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was a name for it.
Yeah. And it's not just feeling like a phony. It's feeling like you're about to be found out. This may be the moment. This may be the time. This may be the day when they find out, I really don't know what I'm doing.
That's right.
How does that affect people?
Well, I think that it's interesting how there is a resonance with us. You know, Maya Angelou said, after publishing her fifth book, I wonder if this is the time they'll find out I've been running a game the whole time. And we laugh at that because we intuitively understand. We understand. And so what it does for folks is it gives you the inability to really connect with, enjoy, or internalize your success. Because you believe that somehow your success was a fluke, it was because you cut corners, it was serendipity, whatever it was, it is not the kind of track into success that other people had. And if other people could see your defective way into success, they would see that you really don't have any merit.
Is this being exacerbated today by the existence of social media? Because I hear so many people talk about the impact of social media, particularly on young people who don't have a lot of life experience yet, but they get on Twitter or Facebook and they see their friends leading these wonderful lives because you only post the good things. You don't post the tragedies. And is that making them feel less competent, more of an imposter?
Yes. You know, in fact, the World Health Organization has just released a bulletin in February that says the perfectionism, the anxiety, the depression among young people mm-hmm. is on the rise. Mm-hmm. And it's for these kinds of reasons. It's the comparing myself to others on social media and just the media in general. Difficult college admissions, making the right social decisions. And we can't just write those trends off.
When you hear somebody like, and I've heard actors say this, and I've heard directors say this, and I've heard people from all walks of life say what Maya Angelou said, this is maybe the day they find out that I don't know what I'm doing or that I'm an imposter, that I'm really not very good at this. And when you hear these accomplished people say these things, you can laugh it off. Oh, it's just, yeah. They're just being ridiculous. They're being silly. But when you say it, when I say it, when people who sit in an office from 9 to 5 say it, it may really impact them, and they actually may believe it because the tangible evidence of just how good they are may not be as readily apparent, correct?
Well, what we find is that the moment someone talks about it, the vulnerability of talking about it suddenly gives you a sense of your humanity, because it's amazing how many of us have experienced this. I'm looking at Carson, and I'll bet as a super achiever, she understands that, especially since 70% of people, and it's not the kind of symptom that lives with you all the time. It might be standing to speak publicly. It might be your first day on a new job. It could be an experience like this, sitting on the radio with you. You know, you're visited by the symptoms, temporary symptoms.
So it doesn't have to be crippling, although it could be.
It could be.
And you could also harness it, it would seem to me, to propel you forward. If you're having these thoughts of self-doubt, wouldn't it spur you on to make sure you've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's and be even better than you have been in the past? Because suddenly you feel a little less competent.
You know, I have heard that line of thought, but for me, what's important is that you have a satisfying life, a big life, a life that brings you happiness and you make a contribution to others through. And so radical confidence is confidence worth fighting for. Mm-hmm. And what's worth fighting for is not the titles of the ego and the perfectionism that comes with that, but having a big life.
Mm. You say, and this I did not know about this syndrome that I had heard about before, but I didn't know that I knew a name for it. You say that some people who suffer from this hide their achievements. If they get an award or a trophy, it goes in the closet. If they get some kind of a kudo, attaboy, they don't tell their coworkers. They don't say anything about it. Why?
Well, they don't feel they've earned them. And what's interesting is you may not relate with this, but chances are you know and love someone who does, and the way you will notice them or the tells that you can look for is this deflection of compliments. Oh, I really didn't do that much. Oh, it wasn't that big a deal. Oh, I'll send you your check at the end of the month, ha ha. Just this inability to, for a moment, say thank you. It was really exciting.
You know, is that not somewhat, I understand that you should be able to take a compliment and say thank you and move on. And that's one way to deflect it, to shut it down if you feel uncomfortable about being overly praised or praised in front of other people for things you actually do deserve, but maybe you don't want them to think that you deserve
it.
So you can say thank you and move on.
Right.
But some people have trouble doing that. And I'm just curious if that comes from childhood, if that comes from this voice in the back of your head, which is partly that of your mother or father saying, be humble, don't get a swell, don't let that go to your head.
Well, there is modesty that the idea of it has a certain place, but I was raised with this idea that achievement was the only thing that mattered. And what I felt.
You're me.
Yeah. I grew up in a military home, and so I came by that naturally. But I think that it's an excessive deflection when literally people, you don't hear about their achievements from them. You hear about it from others, from their good friends who say, do you know that our friend won this or was recognized for this? You don't know anything about it.
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, what's wrong with not wearing those badges? All like a military person, they have all these medals on their chest because they earned them. But most of us in civilian life don't put the medals that we get on our chest and wear them on our suit coat every day. We just kind of put them in the closet. What's wrong with that?
Well, the unhappiness that might be beneath it, because if I don't feel I've earned them, it literally is an unsatisfying experience to me to have achieved them. And I don't want anyone to notice because I don't feel that they're real. And that experience is not the same as being proud but humble.
And you say that this can, not tackling this syndrome head on, recognizing it for what it is, handling it, finding a way to work around it, leads to depression, addiction, unhappiness, and, this is really interesting, unfinished masterpieces.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. Part. Well, there's research that says if I am spreading myself so thin in burnout, and certainly Carson will
I must
speak
say
about
that Carson
that.
Tate is here on the other side of the desk,
yeah.
and she's going to be talking about the other half
right.
of this equation a little bit later on. So
right.
we keep referring to her, but she's actually
yes.
here.
Yes,
so,
yes, and she's nodding. There is the idea that if you are living to achieve, you can't possibly sustain that. Mm-hmm. And the temporary relief that comes from achievement is like cotton candy. It just disperses immediately, and it's on to the next thing. And along the way, there will be long-term masterpieces, real achievements in life that you're not able to complete because of the need. You know, there's just the need for constant achievement. And some are long-term. Some won't be in that cycle that you can attain right away. And so we don't have the long-term view of accomplishment.
Do certain kinds of people, I don't want to say suffer from this, but maybe that is the right term. Do certain kinds of people suffer from this more than others? Is it dependent on your background? Is it dependent on the kind of childhood or the kind of parents that you had who guided you or didn't guide you along the way?
Well, we don't know totally, because some say it definitely does have its roots in the family. For many, I believe it did for me, mm-hmm. Because being raised in a home of constant criticism and conflict can contribute to it when achievement is prized over everything else. But also, there are plenty of people who had a happy childhood and have experienced this, but chose occupations like artists, like broadcast personalities, but there have been studies on physicians and nurses and scientists and even one on librarians. I mean, there's just a multitude of occupations, professionals of all kinds, new CEOs coming into the job that fear they'll be seen as incompetent. So those folks don't necessarily have a bad childhood, but they chose high-stress occupations.
Yeah, you've said that an unhappy childhood is not a prerequisite.
Right.
For
it's
this.
Not.
This isn't something that just average people suffer through. It is something that a lot of high-profile people do this. And we've talked a little bit about this already, but it just seems impossible to understand how a Maya Angelou or a Barbara Streisand or somebody that you know to be incredibly accomplished, and it's not just that you know it, it's that the entire world knows it. How could they possibly suffer from this? How?
Yes, yes. And even Albert Einstein said in his elder years that he felt that so much praise had been heaped upon him and his life's work that he felt like an involuntary swindler. And, you know, I think that there is something in our humanness, in the bones of what it means to be human, that we all recognize, we fear, we're the ones that don't know what's going on.
We're going to talk about how you balance this, how you overcome it, as we go through the next segment of this program. And a little bit later on, we'll talk about figuring out your own personal work style and how that can benefit you as well at the office and perhaps even in regular life. Lou Solomon's our guest in this segment, the CEO and founder of Interact and the co-founder of the TWIST Conference for Women, which we'll find out a little bit more about as well, and the author of Freeing Your Radical Hero, Fighting the Imposter Mindset. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about imposter syndrome, that nagging feeling in the back of your mind that you aren't up to the job and may be found out. Our guest is Lou Solomon, who's written a book about this called Freeing Your Radical Hero, Fighting the Imposter Mindset. And before we get back to that, you're also the founder of TWIST, the TWIST Conference for Women. What is that?
My colleague and I, Carson Tate, we founded this conference in 2012. We were tired of the giant conferences where you can't connect with people or hear yourself. We were tired of the short conferences when there was not enough time to really build relationship. And we thought, well, what if we were able to have a conference in a retreat environment with less than 50 women for rich conversation and true intimate network building, hearing from smart and soulful speakers who would interact with us. Mm-hmm. And that was Twist. We wanted to make it different.
I want to get back to this imposter thing that you would think could be crippling and that everybody suffers from in one way or another. But one of the things that you say about the people who are really affected by this is that it, you would think they would go off into a corner and cuddle up in the fetal position and just disappear. But no, they are gluttons for punishment, you say. They are attracted to high-stress jobs.
Yes.
Why?
Why?
If you think you're a phony and a fraud and you're not real, why would you go and put yourself out there?
Because you're looking for the environment that offers the most opportunity for achievement. And it is a glutton for punishment kind of scenario. But I know for me, the idea of a churn and burn achievement shop was very attractive to me.
And you worked in one, let me tell you.
I did.
People go unnamed.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So the opportunity in broadcast, commercial broadcast, for example, because Arbitron comes in every month, Nielsen comes
in. That's the ratings.
Yes, mm-hmm. The ratings. Mm-hmm. You get a report card every month, and it makes it stimulating, to say the least, that you have to smash projects, not just win projects,
right,
but you have to nail it to the point that when you do, for a moment, it can be satisfying. It's temporary because then you've got to do it all over again.
Like it never ends.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it would seem to me if you're attracted to these high-profile jobs because of this imposter syndrome that you carry around with you, then having the imposter syndrome is a very good thing. Why isn't it?
Because of the unhappiness part. It's if I am successful but I don't believe I am, then I have the stress every day of showing up that way.
During your TED talk, you said that studies have shown that 70% of the people suffer from this at one time or another and to some degree or another, and you said at the time you thought that number was low.
Yes. Yes.
Why?
Because it appears to be a part of the human condition, so much so that I've not talked with anyone who has said, you know, this doesn't mean a thing to me. This is absolutely outside of my experience. I have no idea what it even means. And that includes physicians and so many people that, you know, by all external evidence, everyone would say, oh my goodness, they're so successful. And if there's that kind of pervasive understanding of it, then 70% to me sounds low.
At what point does it become a detriment? If we're all walking, if almost all of us are walking around with some of this.
Right.
At what point does it become a detriment? How do you recognize it? Because the symptoms that we talked about earlier, depression, addiction, unhappiness, those things can be chemical, they can be clinical diagnoses that have nothing to do with this, but then again, could have something to do with it. How do you know?
Right. Well, the first thing I would say is that if you over-identify with achievement, then you have difficulty in valuing self-worth. And if left unchecked, that becomes rampant. But if you confront and deal with it, it can be an exhilarating ride. And it's about discovering self-dialogue, listening for your thoughts, calling that out, talking with people, having a great network system around you, knowing your story. It is about the things that healthy esteem and confidence are connected to, is the very thing that pulls you out of the imposter syndrome, which, by the way, is temporary for many people and doesn't affect their life overall. But for those that it does impact their life overall, there is the suffering.
Does everybody who suffers from this, if everybody who has these moments of imposter syndrome, do they all have this inability to recognize their achievement? Do they all want to hide those achievements, or is that just a subset of the people involved in this?
It tends to be a subset in the band of a more constant experience. For example, if you just have the common trigger of public speaking, where when you stand, you think, I have no clue what I'm talking about, and I don't know why they've invited me to speak here.
That's why I don't do it.
You know, that is...
It's true. That's why I don't do it.
Well, and of course, it's, you know, so evident that it's not true, but for a moment, that is a trigger.
Oh, but it is, Lou. I just ask questions.
Oh, right, Mike. I don't think so. But it is a trigger for a temporary experience of the symptoms, but there are people who literally think that on a less temporary basis that, you know, their achievements are not real. They can't internalize them. They can't enjoy them.
So let's talk about how we get beyond this, whether you have a severe case of this or whether you just have this normal nagging in the back of your head, which is probably healthy to a certain degree because it makes you a little bit better, a little more careful at things and a little better at what you do. You have named the nagging voice in the back of your head, and you talk back.
Yes.
To that voice now.
Yes, I do.
What kinds of things do you say?
Well,
can they be said on the radio?
Right. Yeah. Profanity is helpful sometimes. I believe that a sense of humor is so helpful in this because we get so heavy and introspective that when I began to hear the negative dialogue in my head, which I think is important.
Let's stop for just a second.
Yeah.
When you began to hear it, is that the same as recognizing it? It's probably been there for a long time.
Right.
And you didn't even think of it as a separate voice.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm
absolutely.
Sorry.
No. When you recognize that the mean girlfriend in your head says things like, well, you don't deserve to be here. These people are really smart. Or, you know, you got close, but you still messed up. Or, you know, you have nothing that gives you the right to belong here. That kind of negative input, once you begin to hear it, and I call mine Miss Vader, so that I think a sense of humor is important. You know, the human psyche is much more complex than a Star Wars figure, but if you make fun of it, it helps diminish the impact.
Diffuse it.
Yes. And when I realized I could call it out by saying, is that true? Is that really true? Am I going to go with that thought? Then you begin to build the self-awareness that you need to move out of it.
You also talk about the radical hero.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
The one that fights for freedom from oppressive thoughts is the radical hero, and it's your intuition within you. You know, Steven Spielberg talks about how we need to listen every day to the voice of intuition. Mm-hmm. We don't value that enough as our giftedness, our brilliance.
But how do you recognize the voice of intuition separate from the little nagging tart in the back of your head who is criticizing you and telling you you're a phony? How do you know, how do you distinguish between the two? Because the intuitive voice is a good voice. You should listen to that if you can discern it.
Yes, but it doesn't say terrible things to you. It says empowering things. It inspires you. It tells you those things that run up your backbone. It's a much different feeling. It's the voice of truth. And the nagging, mean kid, imposter voice is anything but that.
But as we have come to learn in this political year, truth is subjective. there are alternative truths. How do you know your truth is your authentic truth? The voice that tells you the truth is really telling you the truth. How do you know?
Have you ever had the experience where you did not follow what your gut told you to do and you were sorry?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, there you go.
All right. In your book, you list four questions that this radical hero asks about what that nagging voice is telling you about yourself. In other words, if the nagging voice is telling you something, the radical hero has four questions to ask. Is it true? Is the first question. How do you know? If you say, well, the voice just said, you're no good at this. Is that true? How do you know?
Right, right. And when you realize you don't know, and what would you be without that thought, and could you move forward without that thought? I mean, it's and that's Byron Katie, by the way, those okay. four questions you can put toward any erroneous thought you might have, and it's a good way out of it.
Well, the first question is it true? The second question is, can you absolutely know mm-hmm. that it is true? And what is, if you can't absolutely know, do you err on the side of caution, or do you just plow ahead?
Well, you absolutely know the voice of intuition. When your gut tells you something, I mean, I know for me, I've woken up and from my toes, I know something.
Okay.
But I do not know what a negative voice says to me. I fear it. Yeah. I don't know from my toes that it's true.
So is it true? Can you absolutely know that it's true? How do you react is the third question.
Right. If you know the core beginning of the action, which is always a thought, and then you see how you have danced around it and made your life unhappy because of that thought, and then you can address, who would I be without that thought?
That's the fourth question. Who would I be without that thought?
And that's the glimpse at intuition.
Can you go too far with the cure? I mean, if you go through all these exercises that you write about and talk about, and you recognize the voice in your head, and you ask that voice all these questions, and you plunge ahead and you change your way of thinking about yourself, and suddenly you're supremely confident. You are the radical, supremely confident person. Can you go too far? Do you run the risk of becoming overconfident, a braggart, somebody who succumbs to the Peter principle because they think they can't do anything wrong?
Well, a big dose of self-esteem will begin to separate you from your relationships if that esteem is based on the ego. So, you know, any self-reflection taken too far can become, heavy and neurotic. So certainly it's about having a sense of humor, too.
All right. Lou Solomon, I hope you understood all this because your life needs to change. Clearly, all of our lives need to change. Lou Solomon is a communications consultant, CEO, and founder of Interact and of the Twist Conference for Women, and author of Freeing Your Radical Hero, Fighting the Imposter Mindset. Living with imposter syndrome can both hold you back and prevent you from enjoying your successes in life. Finding your personal productivity style, though, can help you work smarter, not harder. Carson Tate is a productivity. She's been referred to on this program, and she just happens to be here. Carson Tate is a productivity consultant and founder and principal of Working Simply. She also wrote Working Simply, Embracing the Power of Your Personal Productivity Style, and is the other co-founder of the aforementioned sold-out Twist Conference. Carson Tate, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
So what is a productivity consultant?
Well, that's a person that helps individuals and teams and organizations simplify and streamline their workflow so that they have more time, they're more profitable, and ultimately, for me and my team, our mission is that they find that work-life integration, that balance, and that happiness that they really want in their life.
And how do you get to be that? How do you know what? Here's the nagging voice in the
right,
front of
your head.
Right,
I was just saying, here comes the imposter syndrome, right?
Right? How do you know that you can do these? What kind of training does it take to be a productivity consultant?
Yes, that's a great question. So a piece of it is understanding change and human behavior and habits. And then it's also understanding how people think and process information, and then understanding process and organizational design.
You've already said something that got a lot of people's ears, I'm sure, when you talked about improving that work-life balance, which gives you more time at home. And one of the things you advocate is working simply. Mm-hmm. But what does that really mean?
Mm-hmm. And what that means for me is working from your place of what I call your productivity strengths, because we're all hardwired with a really unique way that we work and process information. And when we lean into that, it's easier. Our work is easier. It's more impactful. We're more effective. We're more efficient. But what I find is that so often we've been told there's a certain way to work, or we need to use this planner, when it might not work for us. So then we feel like a failure. Our work isn't as good as we want it to be. And it's a lot harder to work that way. So we have to turn off the shoulds around you should work this way and really embrace what we know to be true to us.
Yeah, most of the 20th century, people went to work and they had to perform in a certain way, in a certain environment, at a certain time. And they took lunch at a certain time every day. And they had to wear a certain uniform to work every day, whether it was a blue-collar job or a white-collar job. It didn't matter. Millennials today seem to be demanding and getting a different kind of environment and a different kind of work track, if that's the right way to put it. And it kind of fits in with what you're saying. We are not homogenous. We are different people, and we do things differently. We think differently. You talk about finding your personal work style. We all have it?
We all have it. So your work style is how you think and process information, and it's unconscious. However, patterns can be detected, and these patterns are the result of something called your cognitive style. And so once you're able to understand that cognitive style, which I have called your productivity style, then we can start to identify those strategies and tools and systems that are going to work best for you.
And you say that finding this style is essential to success, essential to experiencing less stress, essential to freeing up more personal free time. Well, what is it? What do you mean by that?
Well, because this is your power. This is your personal power when it comes to how you work. And I think a piece of what Lou was talking about around the imposter syndrome, right, knowing your strengths mm-hmm. and really where you are adding significant value and impact in your organization can help mitigate that as well.
You have developed a productivity style assessment.
Yes.
I took this. I have the results.
In your hand.
In my never nicotine-stained hands. And I will present these to you in a moment, and we'll talk about these four different styles that you say we all have. Carson Tate's our guest. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Carson Tate is with us, a productivity analyst or a consultant and the author of Work Simply, Embracing the Power of Your Personal Productivity Style, the co-founder of the TWIST Conference for Women, which is in a couple of weeks at Queen's University of Charlotte. We'll put information about that on our website at WFAE.org, although I'm told it's pretty much sold out. You might be able to sneak in. People don't show up, you know, things like that. So you, Carson, have developed, we talked about everybody having their own personal work style, mm-hmm. and you have developed this productivity style assessment. It asks a series of questions, and then it puts you into one or more of these four style categories: prioritizer, planner, arranger, or visualizer. How would you define those four styles? Mm-hmm.
So the prioritizer is that guy or girl who's very analytical, very linear, very fact-based. They've never met a piece of data they didn't like. They are the ones that write really short emails, a sentence or less. And if you want to drive them crazy, come into their workspace and start talking about your weekend and what your kids did on the soccer field and take a long time to make a point. Rambling drives them crazy.
That's the prioritizer.
That's the prioritizer. The planner is that guy or gal, organized, sequential thinker, very detailed, processed, organized. And they are the ones that have been known to put something on their to-do list that they've already done, just so they can mark it off. And when I say this when I'm teaching, they all start laughing because it's so true. It's so true for them. The arranger is that guy or gal. They tend to be more intuitive, more kinesthetic, highly visual, colorful. They do their best work with and through people, excellent communicators. They're the ones that have the most expensive pens in your office, and if you take their pens, they're very irritated because they have these really nice pens, nice utensil that they use. They don't like it when you take their tools. And then the visualizer, that's that guy or gal, big picture. They are also intuitive. They are what I call my adrenaline junkies. If something is due at 1 p.m., you're going to get it at 12:59, 59, 102. out of sight is out of mind. Lots of color. And they do a lot of work very quickly, and they need variety. Otherwise, they get stale and bored.
So would it be accurate to say that all of us already operate in these modes without knowing it.
Yes. So I say that we're whole-brained. So you might not feel like it sometimes, but we are whole-brained. And so you use and access all four of these styles. But what I'm interested in for you is that we all do have a primary preference, one that we really prefer to use more than others. And it really is innate and unconscious.
And because it's innate and unconscious, we're already working that way in some where we can, because maybe you can't. Maybe you're not allowed to do that in your place of work. But when we can, we do. So what's the value of recognizing our particular style?
So the value is helping you discern, if you're trying to optimize your time or your email, helping you discern what are the tools and strategies that are actually going to work for me. So it cuts down on the time you spend. Okay, I need a new app to help me manage my to-do list. Which one is going to work best for me? Now that I know my style, well, these would probably be a better fit for you. The other thing that is helpful is if we're trying to change a habit, which is really hard, if we use a tool or a strategy that's aligned with our productivity style, it's easier to make that change, and this change is stickier. It lasts longer.
And you often talk about these work styles in terms of enabling leaders. Do you have to be a leader to benefit?
No, not at all. I mean, anyone and everyone who works will absolutely benefit from it. The benefit for a leader is knowing the style on your team, because work style diversity leads to high performing teams. So when you have these four different styles on your team is more effective, it's more productive, because you have a holistic perspective of projects.
So I took your productivity style assessment at your website the other day. I'm not sure what this really means, but before I give you my results, I want you to guess what they are. Now, we've only met today. You've had this 15-minute conversation with me. We haven't talked about how I work, but you've kind of observed me talking to Lou. So tell me what I am. Can you predict that? I'm being very unfair.
No, well, and I will tell you, this happens all the time. Yeah, they're like, okay, who am I? What is my style? So I'm going to guess that one of your preferences is an arranger, and there is a preference for probably the data, the prioritizer.
Okay, very good. I don't know what the numbers mean, but I scored 29. On prioritizer, 29 on planner, 25 on arranger, and 24 on visualizer. Mm-hmm. What does all that mean?
So we're looking for your highest score, which you're tied. So prioritizer and planner. Both of those are very left brain, analytical, detail organized. And being in journalism, it is about facts. And so that's not surprising that the data and accuracy, which is really a prioritizer, is important. And then the structure of your show. I mean, we're hitting every single time mark.
You better.
Right. Or something's going to happen. And then the arranger is that that humor, that warmth, that connection with Lou, that connection with me. And so if we were working, let's say, for example, on your calendar, we're going to look at strategies for that prioritizer planner first.
Because one of my problems in taking this test, and I'm sure this might be true of a lot of people, is that most of us no longer have one job. Most of us have several jobs, and I use the arranger visualizer in other aspects of my life that have nothing to do with this. Mm-hmm. And doing what I do using the prioritizer planner version of me in those situations would not be good.
Mm-mm.
Going the other way around also would not be good. And I just kind of knew this intuitively, and I've also been able to do it because I have the freedom to do it. What if you don't work for somebody who gives you that freedom? For instance, when I was a manager, I would tell my people, this is before the internet, before virtual stuff could be done from home, I would tell my people, I don't care if you come to work. I don't care if I ever see you here. As long as, here are the tasks. Bang, 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 bang. Here when they have to be due. Bang, 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 bang. Get them done. You want to take a 5-hour lunch? You want to go to the movies? You want to come in here at night and work when nobody's here? That's fine. As long as I get the projects on time. Which is a lot of freedom. And I think that's how it actually ought to be, quite honestly. But if you don't have that, how do you do this? How do you shoehorn yourself into somebody else's version of what you should be doing?
Well, so I would first say, let's try not to. And it's an opportunity to have a conversation with your leader or your manager, because ultimately I believe that your leader and your organization wants the best of you. Because if they get the best of you, they're going to get a really great product or a great customer experience. So having a conversation with your leader around your strengths and the impact that that can have on the organization is the first step. And what I'm not advocating is, you know, that we're going to have a radical way of working. No, what we just want is an alignment of the way that you work with your strengths. So if I'm more analytical and linear and fact-based like you, the projects where I'm going to excel are going to be research and data analysis, preparing budgets. So how do I look at doing more of those types of tasks than ones that might be more ideation and creation, which is the visualizer? And so you're leaning into your strengths, which is going to yield a better output ultimately for the organization.
You say that it is our work strategies that impact our productivity and enable us to move beyond busy. What does that mean, moving beyond busy?
Yeah, so I think busyness is a little bit of a drug in our culture.
Yes.
And a badge of honor.
Yes.
Because, oh, I'm so busy, I'm needed, valued, and important, right? I mean, that's what we tell ourselves or what we think others think of us as well. But busyness, I think, is often just a mask, and it's something that we might be hiding from. Maybe we don't really want to look at how we're spending our time because our choices aren't in alignment with our values. Or maybe we don't want to get clear on what our real work is and the impact that we're making because we're not sure. Or we might be afraid or have the imposter syndrome. But busyness is just a mask for insecurities, not wanting to look at what's really going on, or not really owning your strengths.
And it is kind of a drug, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
You get a high on being busy. A lot of people can. A lot of people brag about their abilities to multitask, although we are told that that's simply not true. Multitasking is not possible. Something fails as a result of multitasking. You can't be good at doing two things at once. Other people are always busy and they brag about being good time managers. And you say time management does not work. And you say that in the face of countless seminars and books and training sessions and magazine articles. Clearly, you do not suffer from imposter syndrome. So how can you say that?
Yes. So time management training programs typically assume that our busyness or our overwhelm is the result of our poor allocation of time. I would agree that that's a piece of it, but we work in a multifaceted, complex 24/7 world, and time allocation is not the whole equation.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why I believe that time management training programs don't work, because they're only addressing one facet of how we work and not a holistic approach to how we work. The other thing I would say is there's really good research backing up what I'm saying around these time management programs not yielding the outcome that we want, which is a reduction in stress, improved performance, a greater impact, that if I just better manage my calendar, that's
right.
A piece, but that's not all of it.
Okay. You said that for many years you prized your ability to produce significant amounts of work. So did I. You say that you were focusing on output and not impact. But what if the job calls for output? Here's your stack of stuff. Get it done.
Right. Well, all jobs call for, you know, deliverables have to be produced. For me, it was that what Lou was speaking about, the achievement. And that for me is, oh, I got it done. It was hard and challenging, and I completed it. For me, the distinction is impact is where there is a more significant return on that time investment. It's where you're making a change, maybe helping someone in their life. It's innovating a new product. It's solving a complex problem. A lot of this output, this productivity that we say, a lot of it is busy work. Reports that don't get read, emails that really aren't necessary, meetings that are a waste of everyone's time, that aren't driving towards that strategic goal or why we're really here as a business.
Finding your own personal productivity style, which is where we started here, that whether you're a prioritizer or a planner or an arranger or a visualizer, can make you more you make you better at what you do, and you say free up time for other things. Because if you know how you work and you're allowed to work in that fashion, you will get more done, and therefore you can better balance that work-life connection. But if you're like some people who will go unnamed, if you get better at it because you're allowed to work as a prioritizer or a planner or an arranger or a visualizer and you have more output and or at least more impact, wouldn't that lead you to just keep working so you can have an even more output?
Well, that's a great question. I think that ultimately, no, because once you taste that freedom and the time, more time with your family or friends and personal pursuits or hobbies, I mean, that's engaging and inspiring in its own way. And so that creates a pull in and of itself. You want more of that. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to keep chasing more output.
You talk about honoring the way you work, and that for some people that means, like the president, he doesn't work before 11, really. I mean, he doesn't come to the Oval Office until 11 o'clock. That's his thing. He didn't do that when he was with the Trump Organization. I have no problem with that. That's his thing. If you can get away with it, that's great. I'd be 1:30 if I could get away with it. So honor the way you work. If you like music when you work, listen to music. If you have to exercise before you work, exercise before. If you have to take a break in the middle of it and get up and walk around the block, do it. But what if you're not allowed to do any of those things? What if you like music but you can't have it? What if you gotta get up and walk around to clear your head, but you really can't because you're chained to that desk?
So I would borrow one of Lou's questions. Is that true? So is it true that you are physically chained to your desk and you may not stand up or you may not put on headphones? So I would say check your assumptions and let's find out if it's just a story you're telling yourself, because maybe you don't want to ask the question. And most of the time I've found in organizations, there are very few instances where folks are chained to the desk and unable to take a walking break or put on a set of headphones that doesn't disturb their colleagues to listen to music. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's about performance.
But lighting plays into this and the environment. For instance, I have a very messy desk because out of sight, out of mind.
Yes.
And I worked in a place once where we could not have anything on our desk except the phone and a single piece of paper if we were working on something. I mean, it was insane, but I thought it was. And we had to clear our desks off every day before we left because there could be nothing on the desk, including the phone. It had to go in the drawer, which was insane, but that's how we had to have it. So what if you work in an environment like that?
So we do have some clients that, due to the type of work that they do, there's some security concerns or personal information. You know, in healthcare, you can't have patient records just sitting out and available for everyone. So if that's the case, you obviously have to adhere to that for a broader reason. But it was back to having a conversation and making the case that while I'm in the middle of the project, I do need to spread out. But at the end of the day, my desk will be in alignment with what your expectations are.
So we have less than a minute left. And I'm just curious, if you're a leader, if you're a manager, is it in your best interest to have a blend of all these people around you? And if you are in this blend and you all work differently and each of you drive each other crazy because you're so different, how does it work? And we have like 30 seconds.
Yes. So yes, it does. The highest performing teams have this work style diversity, and you are going to drive each other crazy because your strengths are their blind spots. And this gets back to having a conversation and recognizing that your strengths help me be more impactful in my work as well.
Carson Tabe is the author of Work Simply, Embracing the Power of Your Personal Productivity Style. And you can, what's your website very quickly?
CarsonTate.com.
You can go there and take that test and see who you are. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Thank you for the hour.